This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The 14th Amendment of the United States, Section 3. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of the president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at University of Chicago and NYU. This is an old story that may be a new story again. It's a story that's told. It might be just a scary hour at Halloween, but the possibility remains that Mr. Trump, should he be successful, could be charged as an insurrectionist. And under the 14th Amendment, Section 3, one reading suggests that he would be ineligible to take the office of the presidency in January. Richard, we did this a long time ago, and I've forgotten all the details, but it has to do with, is the president a person who qualifies under this Section 3? Good evening to you.
Yeah, and the answer is he doesn't. But this has been a debate that took place a long time, and what the Supreme Court did, after my good friend and student Jonathan Mitchell did an absolutely powerhouse argument, is they said, if you want to do something like this by way of a charge, it has to come through Congress, because they were right to see that every independent state officer making a charge like this could result in a pockmarked map in which the guy from Maine said you can't run and the fellow from Nebraska said you can't. And since Congress never authorized it, the matter was at an end. And that's the way in which it ought to be. And so what your fantastic story starts to say is that the attorney general on his own motion could arrest somebody when there is nobody in Congress who has authorized this particular conduct. My view is, just to put it, I think, in the most bald term, this is a real effort to try to upset the democratic outcome of a political election, and is, in fact, a high crime and misdemeanor, which would, if he stayed around long enough, subject the attorney general or anybody who participated in it to a serious charge of impeachment. That could be made, although you know the House may be in Republican control right now, but the Democrats still control the Senate. So it's kind of a gesture, but it does tell the seriousness of this. But it's a form of Trump derangement syndrome. The Republicans now find themselves with a winning candidate who's behaved relatively admirably in the last 4 months, or so, last 2 months or so, seems to be winning in the polls, carrying some coattails with him. And the Democrats are increasingly more desperate. And many of them really do believe that the Republic is at an end if Trump becomes president. Most Americans say that, by God, he may have been dramatic, but we did pretty well economically when he was there, and we had peace at the world. So we win on both fronts with him. They can't abide that result, and they may try to go this far. Remember, the Jack Smith case is, in my view, pure political vendetta. And I think in many ways that the Chief Justice was wrong, even when he tried to narrow the definition of immunity, because the key question in this case should have been, and he got it wrong, is whether or not the effort to try to impeach him in the Senate, when it resulted in an acquittal, bars a subsequent prosecution by the administration. The Constitution is actually silent on that issue in a very literal sense. It says if he is convicted, then you go into the civil system, either state or federal, in order to figure out what kind of punishment you want to impose after he's been removed from office. But if he's acquitted, my view is that's a trial, because that's what they were talking about. And if you're acquitted, then double jeopardy protections come in, and you can't go after him for the same offense, which is defined as any of the events surrounding the January 6th insurrection. And the Chief Justice said, no, 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 that doesn't right, because suppose he gets out of office, you can still punish him. I think the answer is, if he's not acquitted because for some reason he cannot be tried, you have to work around the 14th Amendment then. Figure out what you're supposed to say. But if, in fact, he has been tried and acquitted, that follows a well-worn path. And at that point, all future prosecutions should stop. I think he just got it wrong. Most of my colleagues are much more learned than I, and they think that they got it right because they treat the impeachment as a political trial, not a trial. But political trials are subsets of trial. and military trials run by very different principles from civil trial, and yet an acquittal there prevents any other action in federal district courts or anywhere else in the federal system. So I think there's that, which one has to say. And then it's also, if you look at the clause, you have to see what's at the top of it. It says no person shall be a senator or a representative. Now, why are senators and representatives excluded? It's because these are individuals that come from individual states, and you don't have to have a national election on them. If a rebellious southern state decides to put in a former member of the Confederacy, there's nothing that anybody else can do about it politically. All right, it says that. And then it talks about electors of the president and the vice president. Electors have the same vice. They're also people who are tied to a particular state. But they don't talk about the president by name. And so what you have to do is to basically start talking about any office, civil or military. And this is just a very strange reading, because the basic logic here is the president has to win a national election. The Southerners can't run that national election by having their favorite elector. So if you purge the electoral votes in the southern states of all these rebellious people, it's just a general presidential election. And that's the way in which we want it to be. So the president is just out from all of this stuff, because they figured that the political process, after they made the correction in the first part of the sentence, is a sufficient to the day. And so you just, people want to read and say no person, they forget about the other stuff in the introductory clause. That's very bad statutory construction, and this thing should never take place. And what makes it even worse is we know what the motive is at this point, and we know that it's in defiance of what the Supreme Court said on how this is to be done. And we know, if you think there was election interference on January 6th, a very debatable proposition, but not one without some merit, then this thing is just, essentially, it's a coup. You're trying to arrest the guy who's going to replace you in office and hope that he cannot serve. It will leave open the question as well, if you can't have the president, does that also disqualify Mr. Vance? What does that make him president of the United States when things convene? And it also leaves open the question, a Congress on January 3rd convenes. And remember, this is a situation in which I think the House and the Senate turn over before the president. Isn't that correct, John?
Yes.
And so what happens, you now get this new Congress. And my view about it is, given the way that the Democrats have behaved so badly in public, in terms of their just vicious attacks on Trump, the Republicans will keep the House and will gain the Senate by margins that are larger than the ones that the Republicans have in the House today.
Richard, that's how you're bad exploring possibilities, and I raise one that's been brought up to me,
okay,
that as of the 5th of November or thereto, once the election is resolved and someone is said to have achieved 270 electoral votes or more, that person becomes the president-elect. Is that the same as the president? Is there a difference that can...
No, it's not, because he has no official powers.
Well, then therefore, how is that interpreted under Section 3? Who is that person, a president-elect? Is it an officer? Is it a representative?
He's none of them. Look, if the president is not covered, then the president-elect is not covered. The reason why the president-elect is a very kind of difficult subject is all of a sudden he's going to be starting to make appointments, and he's going to have to open up diplomatic relationship with foreign nations and with all the states, because everybody knows that you can't ask somebody to start assuming presidential duties as of January 20th, unless he's entitled to engage in all sorts of negotiations prior to that time. So what it does, in effect, is it licenses him to engage in certain preliminary activities that he could not do when he's simply a candidate.
Does that make him then more vulnerable to Section 3 because he's not the president?
No, because essentially... what this simply says, they talk about who shall not hold office. But when he gets elected as president, he takes the oath of office. That's fine, because they can't stop him from doing it because it was a national election. No, there's nothing they can do. If that were true, then what happened is these energetic Democrats, they could have arrested Trump way back in October of last year.
Remember, it's a fairy tale, Richard. It's not a real,
I know, it's
a story being told.
And I think it will remain a fairy tale. It is such a horrible prospect to contemplate that it isn't there. In fact, I think it's a fairy tale which will only hurt the Democrats even more. because what it does is it shows how utterly desperate they are and how completely unhinged. They don't seem to get it. If they talk to each other, they can't explain why it is that half of the country, maybe a little bit more, maybe a bit less, disagrees with them. And they see none of his virtues, all of his vices. And with respect to Harris, they don't even talk about her virtues, of which she has very few. And they ignore her vices. I mean, it's quite clear that she is incapable of uttering any coherent position on any substantive issue.
Then let us turn to taxes, Richard.
Oh, that's a much better topic.
Yes, much more fun. Taxes and Richard Epstein go together pretty much like the Yankees and the Dodgers to go together for the World Series. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.